right, so welcome everybody. Tonight we are going to be talking about emotional intensity in gifted children. And I think to start out, we really are going to focus the talk on emotional intensity. But to start out, there is sort of this issue of identification and how do you identify giftedness in individuals. And the truth is that people are not identified at the same age. You know, there are some parents who know pretty early on that their kid is probably gifted because they're two and they're reading. There are high school students who are identified as gifted in 10th grade, 11th grade, 12th grade, and it could be because of something like they refuse to go to school. You know, they're not turning in their work, they're not successful in school, and they're refusing to go to school, and maybe somebody thinks, do they have a learning disorder? Let's check this out, and you do an assessment, and you figure out it's not a learning disorder, it's giftedness, or maybe it's giftedness plus a learning disorder, some of that twice exceptional stuff that Sarah referred to. But the identification of giftedness doesn't really happen the same way or in the same process for families because giftedness is not the same. It doesn't look the same. Gifted kids do not all look the same. So what gifted kids are not as a whole, as a group, there are some gifted kids who do look like that. There are some gifted kids who are what we would call nerds, you know, but not all gifted kids are nerdy kids. Not all gifted kids are high achieving. You know, not all gifted kids are worker bees. One of the things, we've got some educators in the room, and we talk about enrichment. Enrichment and gifted education is not just more work or extra work. Gifted kids don't like to fill out more worksheets. You know, and sometimes gifted kids don't like to do work at all because it's pointless to them. Gifted kids are not always compliant. They're not always a pleasure to have in class. And they're not always evenly skilled across all areas of development. And that's really important. When we talk about emotional intensity and we talk about frustrations, oftentimes frustration comes from the fact that a gifted kid might have very advanced verbal abilities, but let's say their processing speed is average. And so they know how they want to talk through something or how they're going to figure something out. But they know what they want to write about, but it takes them so darn long that they get frustrated or they write like a sentence or they hardly put any effort into it because it's not matched up. Their ideas don't match up with how fast they can put it on paper. And so sometimes we have to work towards putting some supports or interventions in place to help with that. Also, I feel like you can't have a gifted talk without really talking about the number, the IQ score. But what I think is really, I guess, the parts that I think are important about this, and maybe not everybody in this room even has a kid who's been identified as gifted, or maybe they don't know their child's IQ score. And that's okay. Honestly, as a clinician, I oftentimes, when I'm working with somebody, I can act as if this kid is a gifted kid. You know, if this is a bright kid and if it walks like a duck and it talks like a duck, from my perspective in my office and the information that parents can use at home to manage things like the emotional intensity piece, we don't always need to know that exact number. And it isn't one number anyway. So if some people maybe are familiar with IQ tests and cognitive measures, if your child has a full scale IQ test that is independently administered, like a one-on-one, not a group test. Oftentimes in school, like in second grade, every kid will take an InView or some other test. That's a cognitive measure. But when I'm talking about IQ scores in this talk, I'm really talking about an individually administered one-on-one, like I'm sitting across the table from a kid doing the IQ test. That test yields a full-scale IQ score, which is really kind of an average of, for all intents and purposes, of different domains of cognitive functioning, things like processing speed, things like working memory, verbal abilities, performance abilities. So there are all these different abilities that are measured in an IQ test, and you get this full-scale IQ score. But what's important from a psychologist's perspective is that those abilities in those domains oftentimes are not even. So as I mentioned earlier, a kid might have very advanced verbal abilities, but their processing speed is slower, or their working memory is average, and or you know, there can be any arrangement of those skills. But oftentimes in gifted kids, it's not clear-cut across the board. They're pretty high in everything. And that can lead to some misunderstandings and some frustrations. So if, let's say, your child's been identified as gifted, and that's sort of put out there, or that's what you share with your child or other people, there's sort of this misunderstanding that gifted kids are really smart, high-achieving nerds who like to do tons of work. And that might not be the case for your kid. So beyond it's not just one number, your kid is not just a number. You know, this is not, a gifted kid is not just an IQ score, and it's an important aspect of the way that individual interacts with the world, processes information, thinks about things, mulls it over, explores things, you know, is such a joy, gets into trouble, creates trouble for you. You know, it's all of this is related to that giftedness, but that's the number is sort of just one part of that. And of course, Sarah mentioned twice exceptional students, students who maybe are gifted and also have a learning disorder or autism or some other type of ADHD or some other type of mental health issue. If you have a child who's gifted or you're an educator and you work with gifted kids, it's important for you to be familiar with Dabrowski's theory of overexcitabilities. So Dabrowski is a Polish psychologist who researches and writes about these overexcitabilities. And the idea is that gifted people have sensitive, sort of overactive brains, if you will. And it crosses over different categories. So things like psychomotor. Gifted kids tend to be wigglers and fidgeters and walkers and talkers. You know, they talk excessively. They can be pretty chatty. They can move a lot. And this is where sometimes there are some misunderstandings about like an ADHD or something else going on in that area. Sorry, I think there might be some feedback here, so I'm going to give you this. So that's one thing. And then there's also the sensual, so senses and sensory aspects. So things like heightened pleasure or displeasure with sound, taste, smell, even things like actually gifted kids oftentimes masturbate younger and more often. That's kind of a part of how they sometimes relax. But we see also an appreciation for the arts. Music. Sometimes little kids who cry at a song because they hear a song and they tell you the feeling of the song. You know, that's a sad song or something like that, and they're maybe like 2 or 3 years old. They understand kind of the emotional aspects of the arts. We also see, obviously, the intellectual overexcitability. So that's just this need to know. That's the curiosity, the wanting to explore. Wanting to figure things out, strong memory. That strong memory is a great quality, but it can get you. It's probably one of the reasons why a lot of you are here tonight. High degree of concentration, same thing. That's a great, great quality to have, but probably one of the reasons why you guys are here, because gifted kids do not give up on their ideas, right? Whether that idea is in line with yours or not, or their peers or not. And then imaginational too. So gifted kids tend to be prone to invention and fantasy. You know, they have these very rich creative lives. Sometimes they lie for fun, you know, not because they're sociopaths, but because they are interested in making stuff up, you know, sort of at its best. They're good storytellers and they're good writers and they can come up with this kind of stuff. At its worst, they're a sociopath, but just kidding. Detailed visualization. And this is an important thing to keep in mind. Gifted kids tend to see their ideas. And this is actually an area of research that is really big in terms of executive functioning and getting people to remember and manage their time and organize their time. We're teaching people to picture themselves doing this. We've been using visual schedules and visual working memory for kids with autism for a long time. Now we're using visualization for typical people who have difficulty with organization, things like that. Visualization, the ability to see yourself doing something, helps you to encode it in your brain and actually do it. That can be a great strength for gifted kids, and it can also sometimes lead to problems because gifted kids tend to see what they're thinking about. If they're thinking about playing, you know, and they've got some Legos or something, they see the finished product. If anything interferes with getting to that finished product, whether it's their motor abilities, whether it's timing, you know, and that you've got to stop and go to school now, or it's a peer, it's a classmate or something like that that has a bad idea about you can't have that skinny of a base. It's not going to work, you know, like I know, I can tell you, I see it. This is how it's got to work. If something gets in the way of the kid achieving their final goal, what they're seeing in their head, that can lead to a lot of emotional intensity. Anxiety. You know, gifted kids see the negative potential result, you know, so they can see the accident. They can see the fall. They can see some of these scary things that they're worried about might happen. Gifted kids can also remember, and so this is sort of that strong memory and the visualization kind of combined. If something bad happened once somewhere 3 years ago, that gifted kid remembers it, remembers how it felt, and when they think about it, they re-experience it. It's almost, I mean, I don't want to be too dramatic, but it's almost a little bit like PTSD in some ways, you know, this sort of re-experiencing of these negative situations. So that can play a role if you've got a gifted kid with some pretty significant anxiety. It could be related to all of this stuff going on. Vivid dreams, too. Okay, and then so the emotional overexcitability, that's what we're really focusing on tonight. That's why you're here. Intense feelings. Gifted kids tend to feel more deeply. They tend to have extremes of emotions. So when I meet a younger gifted kid, we talk about how like, oh, okay, you're the kind of kid who doesn't just feel happy. You feel like thrilled, over the moon, super excited, you know? You're not just a kind of kid who gets, like, annoyed. You get furious, you know? You're not the kind of kid who's, like, a little nervous. You're terrified. These kids have big, big feelings. They have the extreme, which can be wonderful to be around at times, or not. These kids tend to be very sensitive and empathic. They feel the room. They feel people around them. This is huge in the house, and it's huge in the classroom, too. You know, there are a lot of times when we think about, like, what's going on with this kid? Why are they sort of falling apart? Why are they struggling? A lot of times I'm looking at, like, what's going on around them that these kids tend to be barometers for stress and change and emotion around them. So is there a kid in the class who's you know, sort of behaviorally kind of a loose cannon, so to speak, you know? And so this kid is kind of like paying attention to that a lot. Or I've had a young kid who had a lot of trouble in school and finally said something to his mom about his teacher. He was like in preschool or kindergarten. He said something about the teacher, and the teacher confessed to the mom, "I have cancer. Like, none of my students know this, but I am very sick, and I've been." And he was talking about how he was so worried about his teacher and how she was doing. And the teacher was like, "I thought I was like covering up pretty well, but I guess not." So these are kids who pick up on a lot of stuff around them and feel it. And they have strong emotional attachments to people, to places, and to things. So sometimes when you are clearing out your basement and you're about ready to make a big donation to the Goodwill and your kid freaks out about this clearing out of things, it's probably related to the memories too, right? And the visualization and the feelings. Oh my gosh, I remember how I felt. It's almost like if you're a sentimental parent and you put away your kids like baby clothes or something like that, and you somehow stumble across like a onesie or something, you're like, "Oh, I remember this. They were so snuggly, and it's when they couldn't talk. They couldn't like argue with me, you know?" So we have those kinds of feelings. Gifted kids tend to feel that times like a thousand. And we will talk about respect. I make jokes about like a freak out that you're trying to clear out their toys from 7 years ago or something like that they haven't played with in years. But the truth is, we really do have to respect those attachments, respect those feelings when we're working with gifted kids, because they're real. They're real for gifted kids. But for me, I feel like humor is the best way to get through just about anything. So I tend to make jokes about stuff like that. But it's not to say that I'm being insensitive to the seriousness for these kids. All right, so what else do we know about gifted kids? Gifted kids tend to be, I love this phrase, frustrated by the mundane. These are kids who, like, you got to keep the action coming, and this is, boring, right? Gifted kids tend to just know stuff. Like, nobody taught them. They just know it. And you will find yourselves wondering, like, how did you even, was this on Wildcrats or something? Like, how did you, I've never heard of this country before. Where did you? And I mentioned about the vivid memories and the visceral responses. I think about how many people are readers, how many people love to read. And if you're an engaged reader, probably what you're doing is you are putting yourselves in the character's shoes. That's how gifted people kind of go through, I think, a lot of their days. So they're putting themselves in other people's shoes a lot. And that's that sensitivity piece that I'm talking about. That can be a great quality, but it can also be very overwhelming at times if you can't shut it off. Like, especially if you're a reader and you've read a book and it's something that you really connected with and you really loved and it's over, and then you find yourself thinking about the book again or thinking about the characters, that's kind of how gifted kids go through a lot of their days. Gifted kids are not necessarily motivated by grades. I don't know about you as parents who are maybe dealing with, let's say, if you've got a gifted kid who's perhaps underachieving or not turning their work in or something. I realize that you might have a different perspective on this. For me, I think this not intrinsically motivated by grades is a good thing, because I see tons of kids in my office who are very, very stressed about the difference between an A and an A minus, or a 98 and a 97. It really doesn't matter that much. I have a healthy appreciation for kids who are like, "I don't really care what my grade is because I know stuff and I figure stuff out, and what's interesting to me, I like get into that, and who is this teacher to tell me like to put a grade on my work? I don't really need that." I appreciate that, but again, I realize I'm not the one who's like hoping for a scholarship for this kid. So these kids have a finished product in their head a lot of times, and they have this need to want to finish a preferred task or to see an idea through to fruition. So a Lego tower is a little bit easier to deal with. I mean, it can create problems when you need to leave the house and go to school and things like that. But when your kid has, say, decided, like, I'm going to have a summer camp, and I'm going to invite all the kids ages 3 to 5 in the neighborhood. And by the way, Mom, I already made a flyer with your cell phone number on it, photocopied it, and taped it up on trees on our street. And I advertised it's going to be every day over the summer from 9 until 3, and it's for free. Not that I have any personal experience with that. But sometimes these are kids where you have to really work on putting the brakes on. Like, they've got an idea, and what a wonderful thing. What a wonderful thing that you've got someone who's got this idea, and they actually have the, like, skills to carry it out and the enthusiasm, and they can do it. And you have to be the one to tell them, you can't do that. I have a job. I don't want all the neighborhood kids over at my house every day this summer from 9 until 3. These kids can hyper-focus on an area of interest or a task that's interesting to them, which is great. But, like, sometimes when you will read and you're not getting dressed because that's all you're doing is just sitting on your bed reading, and, like, you got to go to school, you got to do other stuff, it can create a problem. And parents of gifted kids are familiar with saying, if you don't do this, I will take your books away, which seems really counterintuitive to parenting, but I'm sure a lot of you have said those words. Mentioned the complete idea and the picture of it. And these kids notice tons of details. So those could be tons of details that are irritating to them or distracting to them. You know, if it's irritating to them, they could have these meltdowns because things are really bugging them, or distracting because they're just very, very perceptive. But those kinds of things can create problems too. So I talked about this already, but at its best, giftedness is really this, you know, I've got a complete idea, I've got a drive to finish it, and that equals awesomeness. Or, you know, I've got a complete idea, drive to finish it, it's time for bed, and that's an explosion. All right, so key components in working with gifted kids' intensities. This is really what I think that it boils down to, is understanding frustrations. So not every gifted kid is the same. You know, you do have definitely gifted kids who care about grades and get maybe upset about grades and things. We'll talk a little bit about that. But understand your gifted kid. You know, there are a lot of commonalities, but a lot of differences. Understand your gifted kid or the gifted student you're working with, and think about what could be potentially frustrating for that person if you're working on these explosions or emotional intensities. Are those frustrations things that are perhaps due to a mismatch between skills and environment, or the demands of the environment really is what I'm talking about? So let's say, you know, you've got a kid who's a real, like, wiggler and talker and mover, and they are active. They are just like a million miles a minute, you know, and they have to sit still and quiet in school. Like, that's a hard thing to have to do, to have to change yourself in that way. Is there a mismatch in terms of, you know, that they're sort of on this mode, this drive to finish a project, and the environment says, like, no, it's time to move on, it's time to transition, it's time to do something else. That can create a problem. Is it frustrations due to interference? So I've mentioned this before, that if you're interfering in a plan or a vision or something that they want to do, or that, you know, this is my area of interest, I'm focused on reading or whatever it is, and now I have to switch to something else, that can create a lot of problems. Due to challenges. So gifted kids are not just, you know, they are not just people who have been blessed with these gifts, right? They are kids who do have challenges from time to time. And so some of those challenges could be academic, and that can be because of something like a learning disorder, say, or it could just be that, oh, I never had any exposure or interest or experience with fill in the blank, you know, division or whatever, and I just didn't devote any time or energy to thinking about it yet. I haven't figured it out yet. And now all of a sudden I have to actually pay attention or think and stop and focus on that. That can create a challenge. Physical challenges too. So sometimes, and I'm not just talking about a physical disability, although of course that could happen, but I'm thinking about more the kid who knows, they see what they want to do and how they want to do it, and they can't physically make it happen. You know, whether that's in a sports related kind of thing or, building or something, riding a bike, bike riding can be a real challenge for gifted kids, and they just refuse to do it. I don't know, we should do a study and find out how old kids in this room learned how to ride a bike. If your kid is not of bike riding age yet, hire it out. It's probably a better way to spend your summer. And social challenges. So gifted kids oftentimes do have social challenges, whether it's because it's hard to find some peers interested in the same kinds of things, or if it's because kids have to work together a lot, and whether that's in a structured way, like a group project, or just playing together involves, kids go from sort of playing side by side to playing with each other. And when you play with each other, you have to there's a lot of negotiating and actually a lot of talk that goes on in typical kids who are, 3 years old. There's a lot of okay, I'll be the mom, you be the dad, we're going to make spaghetti, then we're going to go to Hawaii, and we're going to do this. And there's the whole setup going on. Gifted kids can be very good at that verbal part of it, right? And sometimes they're better than their peers. And so the peers are I don't follow that. Let's go back to the spaghetti. But it can also be that gifted kids, that idea in their head that they already see and it's that way and it works pretty well in their head. Sometimes we refer to that as being pretty rigid or inflexible. And that doesn't fly with peers. You've got to do, typical kids, when they're playing with each other, they are actually very, very sophisticated at figuring out how much can I sort of push you to do what I want before you decide I'm just going to walk away. And kids are really good at giving you just enough to stay playing, but I get to do my idea. They can be very sophisticated in that way, and gifted kids tend to not want to deal with it. I work with a young man who told me that he remembers when he was in preschool, he would go to a center where no one was playing, and he would start playing with whatever it was, the sand or the water. He didn't even care what it was, but as soon as the other kids came over, because, by the way, he's very interesting, so whatever he was playing probably looked attractive and appealing to the other kids. So they would come over and try to play with them, and he would just move on to the next center where nobody was there, and then they would follow him, and then he would move on to the next one. So frustrations due to challenges. This, I think, is not recognized nearly enough. Gifted kids can be frustrated due to an accumulation of irritations. When you have a gifted kid at home or at school and you find yourself saying, this comes from out of the blue, I don't know what's happening, I don't know what's setting him off or her off, I think about throughout the day, what are the kinds of things that are bugging this kid? I worked with a boy who was in third grade, and he told me that when people make grammatical errors in their speech, it drives him crazy. Third graders make a lot of grammatical errors in their speech. He made me very self-conscious when I was talking to him. I was so those kinds of things that build up, well, he manages. He managed throughout the day. He was coping. He's dealing with it throughout the day. But after a while, he's just tired of dealing with it, And so there would be a little bit of an explosion. These kids are pretty good at keeping it together all day at school. And then the second the car door slams at the pickup, they melt down, or freak out or go crazy or whatever term you use in your house. They lose it as soon as they're sort of in the comfort of their home or around their parents and away from their classmates. But those accumulation of irritations is something to think about and be able to figure out as that kid gets older, like, what kinds of things bug you? And then pay attention to how many times those things probably come up in a day. Showing respect. So if you are working with a gifted kid or living with a gifted kid, I cannot understate the importance of respecting that kid and showing respect for that kid. You know how I told you that these gifted kids, they sort of feel other people's feelings and they pick up on lots of stuff? They see through baloney really easily, and they know how you feel about them. So if you are a teacher or a parent or whatever who is, like, you're really having a hard time, whether it's keeping calm or you're feeling a bit threatened by this kid's, like, ability to say that's not true. I mean, a lot of kids, I can't tell you how many times they get in trouble for, like, pointing out when their teacher is wrong about stuff, you know, and or they've done extra research or they're interested in something, so they just know a lot more about it, and the teacher will say, no, I don't know. And they're like, no, I'm telling you. Like, this is a real thing. I know about it. My parents sent me to camp there for a summer, and, you know. So showing respect for these kids, because you really won't get anywhere if that kid doesn't feel like you respect them, and genuinely so. So find whatever it is you respect about that kid and help their teachers too. So that respect has to be mutual, because gifted kids will respect you, I believe, if you respect them and you're honest with them and open about working together. You also have to show respect for the task. And this is mutual. You know, we've got, so if you're trying to work together to accomplish something, you know, we have to, there's this sort of engagement that has to go on to help a gifted kid feel like that task is meaningful. If a kid feels like this is boring and pointless work, whatever that, what is that called, the core, common core, is not a friend to the gifted kids, right? Because when it's like, I figured out this math problem, I already solved it, here's the answer, now why do I need to do it two other times and draw, like, pictures about it and write it out? And you want me to explain how I know that 6 plus 7 equals 13? Because that's math, you know, like, it's in my brain. Those are the words that kids write down on paper. How did you come up with the answer? It's in my head. You know, like, I don't know. It just, I know it. And we have to show respect for feelings and the thoughts and the ideas and the intensity of the gifted kid. So when they've got a plan that you're like, we got to put the brakes on that, allowing yourself to listen and think through and talk about, well, how can we make this work maybe in a way that works for both of us is a good way to go about things. Because it's hard to put the brakes on. It's definitely hard to change minds. And then respect for boundaries. So that's, I think, an important thing that we'll talk about in terms of whose feelings are we dealing with. But an intense kid, you know, changes the room. An intense kid, when they laugh, we laugh. They tend to be very contagious and engaging. They are the kids who, when they're at their best, everyone loves them. And when they're at their worst, that's not the case, right? Like, when they're at the, I mean, these are the kids who teachers develop drinking problems about. These are the kids who make the day tough or wonderful, you know, and it's contagious, and everybody responds to them. So when we're talking about these really intense moments, gifted kids have a way of sucking you into their intensity. You know, if they're super anxious about something, everybody escalates. If they're super upset about something, everybody escalates. If they're digging their heels in, everybody gets on the defensive, you know, and we kind of react. We feed off of gifted kids, and they feed off of us. But when we're dealing with their intense emotions, it's very important to remember that their feelings are their feelings. We don't have to feel the same way that they feel. And that's hard to do, but just recognizing that gets you closer to that goal. Detaching. It's so important for teachers, parents. When a kid becomes emotional and their intensity is escalating, that's when you know you need to detach. And you also have to detach. And did I mention that you should detach? Why? As I mentioned, gifted kids have this ability to draw you in. They're going to suck you into the way that they feel. They are sensitive to your emotions. So as you're becoming frustrated or mad or upset or anxious, they are feeling that, and it's adding to their own feelings. They have strong verbal abilities, so they can debate with you. You know, and again, I mean, we respect kids, and they have very good ideas. They will debate with you, and they will sometimes have very good points that will make you question your side of things, you know, for good reason sometimes. They can be very good at identifying your weaknesses and telling you about them. They do that on purpose. And they are not, I will reiterate, this does not mean they're sociopaths. They are emotionally intelligent people who know that you are dieting and you are concerned about your weight. And when they're mad at you and they want you to get mad too, they are going to comment about your weight. Or they know what kinds of things drive you crazy. And they will do those things. Again, not developing sociopaths here, but this is something that they do. And that is why you need to detach and make it a lot less rewarding. They can use very powerful and scary language. So this is what ends up, you know, a lot of people end up calling me about, is this powerful and scary language. These are kids who are upset. They're in their room. They are screaming and yelling, "I don't deserve to live. I should just die. Nobody loves me. I'm not worth anything." These kids have strong verbal abilities. They have strong feelings, and they know how to express those feelings in a very poetic way sometimes. That sounds really scary to adults when you've got like a 5-year-old talking about that. You know, it's not necessarily that these kids are suicidal and depressed, although obviously you do want to take those comments seriously. But a lot of times, more often than not, those are things said in the heat of the moment, and that passes when they calm down. And that ability to finish and hyper-focus. So, you know, there is that phrase about locking horns. And gifted kids, like, if you lock horns with them, they will often win because they know how, unless you're, you know, more gifted than they are, I guess. But they will hyper-focus, you know, on that argument or what they're upset about. And so if you continue the argument, you continue what they're upset about, they can keep that going for a while. Oh, and, you know, typical, like, preschoolers, and this is sometimes when people start to think, oh, maybe there's something different about my kid. Typical preschoolers, when they're upset about something, you can distract them really easily by something shiny or, a TV or a lollipop or something. That's not the case with gifted kids. You know, they're not easily distracted from their frustration. And then the anxiety layer. So I mentioned those vivid and visceral memories. If you can picture your parents dying, you know, and you not just picture your parents dying, but the part that I think gets gifted kids is that they actually feel what it would feel like if their parents died. A boy that I can remember was very upset when he heard about a tragedy in town. There was a death of a police officer a couple years ago, a year or so ago. And he told me he was very upset about it for a long time. And he told me this kid was like in second grade, maybe third grade. And he told me that he just kept thinking about what it was like for the mom to tell her children about that. And that's something that most second and third graders don't really like imagine, that kind of stuff. So then it kind of triggered these thoughts about, well, what would happen if something happened to my parents, and how would I feel, and all that stuff. So that ability to think through consequences. So a lot of kids with anxiety, we work on things like what if thinking, and helping kids with anxiety or helping people with anxiety, you know, estimate the likelihood that something's going to happen, and it's probably not very likely. Gifted kids are very good at coming up with what ifs. And if there's something that is potentially like something that could happen, they're pretty good at pointing that out too. So we oftentimes see, when we're talking about emotional intensity, what is really a reaction to anxiety, and that is when people are anxious, they go into fight or flight or freeze. They will turn into a demon. You know, they will fight with you. You don't even recognize that kid sometimes, because they will say things and become physically aggressive. They will avoid. You know, they will not go into school. They will not go into the birthday party or whatever. They will freeze. They will just shut down and stop talking. And they'll do that sometimes for a really long time. So the first thing to do when you are trying to detach is label it. Just tell yourself, and it's silly, but actually being able to, like, almost like you're watching a movie, like, it's not happening to you. It's happening to somebody else, you know, like, wow, he's having a really powerful reaction to that. You just say it in your head. You're identifying it and labeling it that is what is happening to him or her, not to me. Embrace yourself and remember your plan to detach and stay calm. You might need to take a breath. You might need to take a minute and walk away or something like that. But what you're really going to do is just allow some time and space to work. So you're just going to back up. You're going to give this kid some time, however much time they need, even if they're in their room yelling and screaming about that they don't deserve to live. You're just going to let them yell and scream in their room for a little while to get it out. And you're going to congratulate yourself on not getting sucked in. And I was talking with a guy who is like 16, and he was telling me, he knows it bothers his parents and his sister when he's in his room yelling, and he tries to do it when they're not home because he doesn't want to bother them, but sometimes that's the only way he can think through and move on and get it out of his head and, like, be able to move past it. So he was really saying, like, sometimes when I'm yelling like that, it's actually not helpful for me to stop. That doesn't make me feel better. That is my way of getting it out and being able to move on. And in the moment, when this intense reaction is actually happening, don't try to reason with that person. Don't try to give consequences. So if the kid in the moment knocks something over on their way up to their room, you know, they throw something, there's a hole in the wall or whatever, they hit you. In that moment, you're not going to say, you lost your iPad for the rest of the day or whatever. You're not going to try to give that consequence in that moment. You may need to return and have a conversation a little bit later about what's going to happen. You know, you threw something and now there's this hole in the wall. How are we going to deal with that? But in the moment, you're not going to get anywhere. It's just going to make things worse or keep it going longer. You're not going to try to remind your kid about any strategies. So if they've learn some strategies to relax or calm down, or they're working with the therapist or something like that, when they're in their moment, it's not the best time to say, oh, remember Megan taught you about breathing, let's take some deep breaths. They will have some choice words about breathing, and probably me. That's not the time to remind about those strategies. Actually, it's best for you just not to talk during that time, and I'm not making a joke. You really just stop talking, give some time and some space, And when things calm down, then you can talk through it. And don't panic. So if you're hearing those strong words, those scary words, or it seems like something really awful is happening, remember, these kids are by nature very intense. So whatever they're saying, and you know, when this moment passes, they're going to be much better. They're going to return to you. And your goal over time is for the intense reactions to decrease, because you're going to understand frustration. They're going to build some coping skills, you know, that those moments in their room yelling and screaming or whatever it is that's happening is going to be shorter and shorter and occur with less frequency and longer duration in between episodes. But those are probably going to happen. And don't panic when it does. So their feelings are not your feelings. Their interests are also not yours to take over. So, you know, gifted kids, they suck us in. They get very enthusiastic about something. So you've got a kid who all of a sudden is like really into dinosaurs and dinosaur bones or something. And we're like, wow, oh my gosh, well, I saw the Science Center has a paleontology camp and I'm going to sign you up for that. And you can also do the summer experience where you actually dig up dinosaur bones and you can create. And so we come up with like, this is an awesome opportunity for you. I'm going to give this to you because you like dinosaurs and you like dinosaur bones. And we turn it into something more than our kid actually wanted. You know, they're just interested in dinosaur bones and they're interested in going to the library and looking at books about dinosaur bones. It doesn't have to be a competition. It doesn't have to be like, now this is your career or you're the dinosaur bone kid and that's what we're going to talk about and that's what you're going to get and all this stuff. If your kid's intense about dinosaur bones, let your kid be intense about dinosaur bones. You can support them. You can listen to them. If they ask to go to camp, or you might tell them there's this camp or something, but it doesn't mean that you avoid the temptation to jump on it and run with it. And let your kid kind of take the lead there. All right, so remember, gifted kids are not always motivated by grades. They're not always motivated by their capabilities. Just because they can do something and just because they can do it very well doesn't mean that they will or that they want to do it. They're really motivated by their desire to know, their desire to explore, their curiosity, their need to question things, unless they care about grades and perfection. There are a lot of gifted kids who really do care about grades. They're very frustrated. If they get something wrong, they don't want to make any mistakes. Maybe they don't have a lot of practice with challenges. You know, maybe earlier on in life, they just knew stuff. They just got it, and they never really had to work at things. But as they get older, they probably will have to work at something. And it might just be getting along with somebody else or doing a group project or something. But they might not have that much practice with challenges. They might not want to jeopardize their standing. So they might not want to be found out as someone who doesn't just know stuff and someone who's not so smart. Because if you think about, you know, gifted kids are kind of used to, even if you try really hard not to, when all of a sudden you're like with grandparents, it's, Charlie, tell Ghani about dinosaur bones. And Charlie's been reading all about it. Now, what's this dinosaur and what's that dinosaur? He knows all the dinosaurs. You know, and we kind of like, it's exciting to us and it's cool for us and we sort of like show it off. We're not trying necessarily to put our kid on this pedestal who's afraid to make a mistake, but we think it's cool. And they pick up on that. And they don't want to disappoint. They don't want to be the kid who makes a mistake or not be up there. And uneven skills and abilities can lead to the wrong conclusions. So sometimes when kids have trouble with a certain area, they might find themselves, this means that I'm dumb or I'm not smart, and feel very frustrated with that. So this is where people have probably heard about growth mindset. Carol Dweck is a psychologist who writes a lot about mindset. She has a very good book and also probably more than one TED Talk on the topic. But really, I guess sort of the the Cliff Notes, is for parents and teachers, we want to make sure we're focusing on the process and not the outcome. So if a kid is working really hard to do something, to accomplish something, or they're being very organized, coming up with their plan for a summer camp or whatever it is, and they're getting their materials ready, or they're really sticking with an idea, we want to praise that. Wow, great job sticking with that idea, or you really sorted all that out. I'm so impressed with how you figured out how to make sure that you raised that money for that lemonade stand or whatever it is. You can praise the process, but not necessarily the outcome. Oh, you got an A+, great, you know, or goals scored or something like that. We want to try to avoid praising the outcomes and focus more on the process. We are going to try to use language carefully. So things like instead of using labels like you're so smart and you're so gifted, I like saying things like you're the kind of kid who has a brain who's just like so curious about stuff and you like to really figure things out. You know, so you're kind of shifting the focus of your attention. You know, your brain works really fast. And like when you're interested in something, you are at the finish line. And sometimes it's hard because we have to kind of slow down a little bit. You know, so you can do things like point out the positive of how their brain works. You might point out the potential trouble. Like, you know, you're the kind of kid who like you see the finished product and you know exactly how it's going to work. And sometimes it's hard when you're playing with friends and you have to kind of let them try their ideas out a little bit. But I know you can do it. I know you can sit back and say, it's not always my ideas we have to do. I'm going to let my friend try. So you point towards what they can do. And then we're talking about engaging gifted kids. When we're talking about problem solving or discipline, things like capitalizing on their abilities to solve problems. You know, oh, we're really having trouble getting out of the house in the morning. What can we do differently? Like, that's a great thing to put to your kid to help them figure out how do we need to change things around here. Gifted kids are very good at figuring out solutions if they're allowed to. Their good reasoning abilities and verbal abilities help them do this. And they're motivated by what matters to them, what they deem as important or valuable, not doing something just because they're told to. And I think that gets to a lot of the respect stuff that I was talking about. A lot of gifted kids say to me, like, just because he's the teacher, I don't know why I have to respect him. He treats us like we're babies or whatever, you know. But they say similar things like that, that just because you're the grown-up doesn't mean I should have to listen to you or you should respect me too. Ross Green is a psychologist who wrote a book called The Explosive Child, and he's written several books. Raising Human Beings is his newest book. But he focuses on problem solving, collaborative problem solving with kids. It used to be called collaborative problem solving, but it's now he changed it to collaborative and proactive solutions. But it's sort of a way of working through and arriving at a solution with your kid. It builds on executive functioning, so planning, thinking about consequences, slowing down, thinking rationally instead of feeling. And it really is built on this mutual respect. So, like, you've got a problem with the way that I don't give you enough time in the morning to do whatever it is you want to do. I've got a problem, which is that I'm concerned about getting to school on time. How are we going to solve this together? What are the solutions we're going to come up with together? When a kid is involved in coming up with the solution, it's much more meaningful to them. It makes sense to them. It matters to them. And they tend to go through your plan because it's not just your plan. It's your plan and their plan together. And it's that process that I think they tend to respect. So just a couple more slides and then I'll take questions. But we think about, I think about sort of all of parenting as kind of like a bank account, you know, and you're making deposits and withdrawals from the account all day, every day. Deposits are things like, you know, attention or opportunities for kids to explore things that they want to explore. And withdrawals are things like demands, whether it's, okay, go get your shoes on, or it's time to go to school, or come to dinner, or go to bed. But think about focusing on making deposits. You know, I talked about that accumulation of annoyances and irritations. Deposits help to combat that accumulation of irritation. It sort of shores you up. I've got more resources for all of, I've got more built up so that all of the withdrawals throughout the day, I've got sort of this positive balance. So enrichment without strings attached. You know, like, sure, I'm just going to take you to the library. You can look at whatever you want to look like. I'm not going to throw more books in your face about dinosaur bones, or like now it's a college text about dinosaur bones or something. I'm just going to let you look at whatever you feel like looking at about dinosaur bones, because this is just your time. Demand-free periods. So actually think about, you know, breaks in the day when you're not giving instructions or setting demands on these kids, but that's kind of their time to just do what they feel like doing, obviously within reason. And allowing appropriate independence and decision-making and things like that. And then finding support and building support. So for the child, making sure that you're communicating that healthy appreciation for the giftedness, the intensity, sort of as it comes, right? Like, so the good and the bad, you know, the intensity of the joy, the intensity of the fury, all of that is what makes you awesome, you know, and it's hard sometimes, but we'll help you through, kind of thing, that you really show and communicate that appreciation. And support for the kid includes things like building skills. So whether it's building, you know, regulation and calming down kinds of skills, whether it's building advocating for yourself appropriately or respectfully, or, you know, social skills, things like that. Support from schools, so making sure that your school is on the same team as you, and that you're sort of talking through what's going on at school, what's going on at home, how can we help kids here. Support for the family, so obviously Connecting for Kids, Sarah referenced a lot of support that Connecting for Kids has for families in terms of how to work through some of these issues. And then when I say from your tribe, I think of this really as sort of that demand-free period for some of these kids. And I think about, I know that not every family has access to this, but if you do, think about how to use it to your advantage. I said, gifted kids tend to be like, I mean, they can be both the teacher's dream and nightmare. You know, the neighbor's dream and nightmare. I mean, like, usually it's people, if you don't live with this person or you're not trying to teach this person, oftentimes gifted kids are everybody's favorite person in the world because they're interesting, they're engaging, they're usually like pretty bubbly and talking and stuff like that. If there are people who enjoy being around your kid, and they're safe people, allow them to do stuff with your kid. You know, whether it's an aunt who's going to take your kid for a sleepover, just one-on-one, and that's going to be like some demand-free time, and that's like their time to do what they feel like doing. Use that stuff. If there's a neighbor who walks their dogs, and your kid likes dogs and likes talking to that neighbor, and they join the neighbor to go on the walk, and they get some of their walking and talking out to somebody fresh ears, you know? That kind of helps you recharge a little bit, and it allows your kid to be that magnetic person that other people really respond to and get that positive response from those people who love your kid during that 10-minute, 15-minute walk because they don't have to put him to bed at night or whatever. Okay, so resources, the National Association for Gifted Children, you can go on the website. There's tons of resources. And articles there, same with supporting the emotional needs of the gifted, SANG. Some books here I list, Parenting Gifted Kids, Tips for Raising Happy and Successful Children, Emotional Intensity in Gifted Students, Living with Intensity, that goes into a lot of those overexcitabilities. Destination Imagination, I'm not sure if many people have heard of that. So Destination Imagination I think it used to be Odyssey of the Mind, or like Destination Imagination and Odyssey of the Mind kind of combined into one. But it's oftentimes a parent-led program. There are several chapters around here. Are there some Destination Imagination representatives here or something? But it's a great program, and it's a lot about problem solving. Grown-ups aren't supposed to talk. You know, the kids are supposed to solve these problems and work together and things like that. It's not only for gifted kids, but it tends to draw a lot of gifted kids. Connecting for Kids has tons of resources. My office, we've got individual and family therapy. For younger kids, we have social skills groups or play groups to help kids, you know, go through a plan with other kids. For teenagers, we've got emotion regulation groups. On March 10th, one of my colleagues is doing a collaborative and proactive solutions workshop for parents. Our website and newsletter, you can sign up for our newsletter if you want to. There's some resources and information there.
A parent asked, you mentioned a lot of emotional intensity that had to do with anger. What about depression?
Yeah, so a lot of my examples are sort of anger, intensity in anger or like fury. But what about the opposite? Sadness, kids who are crying and kids who are, yes, I see that a lot. I mean, it's the same kind of thing. And the kid who I was talking about who was like imagining the tragedy, yeah, that's a kid who spent a lot of time crying, thinking about that, really upset about it. It can look like depression. Sometimes it is depression. Sometimes it is processing and thinking through these big concepts and big emotions that are tough for adults to deal with, but that in a smaller, you know, with that uneven development, you've got a kid who maybe has some emotional maturity to think through how awful something might be, but maybe not necessarily the skills developed that, like, this stuff happens in the world, and it's horrible, and it's sad, but there's a lot of good in the world, too. And so sometimes they don't have that perspective. Sometimes we see the depression or the sadness with at themselves. So a lot of frustration with not being able to do something or not wanting to make a mistake. And if they make a mistake, being really hard on themselves. So I would actually leave them alone, letting them know that you're there to talk about it if they want to. Like, seems like you're pretty upset about this. If you want to talk, let me know. I'll give you some time, you know, and you let them process through that. And they will come to you if they want to, or they'll calm down and move on. And so I'm glad you brought that up. So the question is really like, you know, a kid sort of melting down or exploding or whatever, they're having these moments and you're detaching, but should you be addressing this? Because really we want people to be able to regulate themselves so they're not like at work flying off the handle, or God forbid being a parent flying off the handle at a kid who's frustrating them, right? Because none of us ever do that, because we've all grown up to regulate our emotions. But in the moment you detach, after the fact you can talk about things like, that seems pretty tough, or like, I notice you're having a lot of these times where you're feeling so frustrated and upset. What can we do? What makes it better? If that is happening at home, primarily, you know, if a kid is 10 and that kind of stuff you see at home, but when they're with their friends, when they're at their sports stuff, when they're at school, that stuff doesn't come out, I'm not as concerned about it, because it's like we all do things in private that we don't do on our jobs or, you know, with our friends or whatever, but that maybe our families know about us. So I'm not as concerned about it, because that's a part of working through, but you would address, you know, how do we manage those feelings?
Another parent then asks, well, what do I do if my child is acting out in public?
And it's happening out and about, like you might work on that in therapy with them. It can be something that just like over time decreases, but I guess I take the approach of like, if they're bothered by it and you're bothered by it, support can't hurt, you know, so therapy tools to manage the frustration, things like that can't hurt.
A parent asked, what do I do if I try to detach, but the child follows me around?
Yeah, so you're trying to detach, but a kid's following you around, talking to you, trying to engage you, things like that. I would continue. Yeah, I'm going to make this happen. I would continue to walk away, you know, not talking. If you can, you know, whether it's go to the bathroom or go outside or whatever. And sometimes, I mean, I will say to a kid, listen, you're really upset and I do want to, this sounds like a big problem to solve. I do want to help you when you're calm. I'm going to take a minute to get calm and then we can talk. And if you're building up strategies like the collaborative and proactive solutions or this kind of working together to solve some of these problems, once your kid is sort of trained up to that and they know that you'll help them through those problems, they won't feel that powerful need so much to follow you around and like, we need to get this done, because they know to trust when you say, this is a big problem, we'll work through it, I need to get calm, then we can talk. They'll know that you're going to actually follow through with that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the question is, when you've got a kid who's like, why did God create venomous creatures? Why did this happen? Why did that happen? Actually, when I was talking about the, you know, find a neighbor who your kid can walk around with, I mean, I'm not kidding, but I think that as much as you can, kind of thinking about who cares about that stuff and who's got a little bit of time to, like, listen to that stuff, whether it's FaceTiming a grandparent or, you know, but kind of allow them to do those questions. It is okay, though, because kids will have to learn this, whether it's with you or with their peers, that not everyone wants to think about things for as long as they do. So it's okay to say, wow, it's so cool. You've got a brain that just doesn't get tired thinking about this stuff. My brain's a little bit tired now. So let me finish this. And then, you know, when we're snuggling tonight, we can talk about some of that stuff. So I think it's okay to compartmentalize and to say, like, I don't have the longevity for this, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really good question. So if a kid, their reading abilities are far above, let's say, grade level and sort of what their sort of maturity is able to comprehend and understand, and some young adult novels or like Judy Blume books have a lot of facts of life in it that I think, you know, but so if you've got a first grade girl who's reading some of these books that are meant for more like sixth graders, there is, I think, exposure there to things that are sort of beyond what they can comprehend or really like handle. So I would encourage you to read sort of with, although sometimes you can't read as fast as they can, or as, you know, you don't have the time to do that. But I would talk to librarians too and find out, like, actually, the Westlake Library has Rebecca Shook is a great librarian. Like, talk to her, talk to the school librarians if your kids are in school to find out what's some material that they might be interested in that wouldn't be too inappropriate for them. Mm-hmm. So Common Sense Media is a great resource for figuring out, like, what kind of shows, books, things like that are maybe appropriate or inappropriate for your kid. Yeah. So the question's about, like, if, you know, test scores come home and one kid does well and one kid maybe has more trouble, kid kind of hiding scores and things because they don't want to make their sibling feel bad. I mean, personally, I'll tell you, and this might work in your house, I don't talk about grades or test scores or anything like that. Like, I try to portray that I don't really care that much about that. I care about the comments on the report card, you know, if a teacher says that you're like working hard and things like that's what I care about. I don't say, oh, look at you're in the whatever percentile or you got this grade. I just think that for most kids, there's really not much value in talking about the actual grade. It's more on like you're getting your work in, you're a good student, your teacher thinks you're participating in class. I would focus on that stuff. And if your son wants to talk about his grade because he's proud of it or something, you say, I saw that. That's great. But I try to pay very little attention to scores and grades for that reason, and also the opposite of growth mindset is fixed mindset, and we talk about perfectionism and stress and things like that, and I just think it's not worth creating that kind of problem. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So when a kid just knows stuff and they don't have to work at something, but they eventually run into calculus, how do you help foster the work ethic? Process. So find whenever they're doing something, like even if it's something that they're interested in and they're, you know, they're reading about it, they're looking at books, they're watching shows or whatever, it's like, it's so cool how you stick with something. You know, so you start praising things that you know, their behaviors that you know they're going to need when they run into calculus or whatever other challenge it is. So if it's sticking with something, wow, you're really patient through that, you know. And it could be like sitting through listening to something that they already understand. You could say, wow, you really, you know, you were really patient with that. I could tell you already got it, but you sat through, you listened to it. That showed a lot of patience. That showed a lot of whatever it is that you want to label it. But something like that. So then you're building this sort of focus on the behavior that's going to be what you need to get through calculus. Yeah.
A parent asked, what do I do when I'm trying to detach and my child will say, you're leaving because you don't love me?
Yeah, because remember about how they're so good at like picking up on what bothers you. So telling a parent, you don't love me. You just wish I was dead. You don't even want me in this family. They will say those things, especially as you're trying to detach. In the moment, saying, I do love you. I'm just trying to get you to calm down. That's not going to change anything. But after the fact or, you know, before the fact, because you know it's going to happen again, you can say, I'm really working hard on staying calm when things get upsetting around here. So my plan to stay calm, I'm going to walk away. I'm going to go to my room. I'm going to take some breath, whatever you want to tell them you're going to do. But I would say, you know, when I do that, it doesn't mean I don't love you and I do want to talk to you. I do want to help you through it when we're both calm. And so you warn him of that. And then when he is calm, you can say, you know, you were saying that stuff. I do love you. I do want to help you. I got to get calm first. I think we need to be calm to work through the problem.
A mom said, my son will have meltdowns in public when he's on the soccer field, when he's in play groups. Should I do individual therapy? Should I do group social skills? I'm not sure how I can help him best.
You hear? Okay. All right. Thanks, everybody. Thanks for the turnout. Stay tuned for more resources.